Welcome to Witch Hunt. I'm Josh Hutchinson.
I'm Sarah Jack. Today, we speak with Brendan Walsh, a scholar of early modern intellectual history and religion.
We focus on an account of a 17th century demonic possession in Connecticut.
The story was included in Cotton Mather's Memorable Providences Relating to Witchcrafts and Possessions.
Brendan discusses the history of exorcisms in England and New England.
We'll meet notable figures like English exorcist John Darrell and, of course, Cotton Mather.
Brendan explains how these historical events reflect societal fears and values of their times.
This episode explores complex characters and narratives, such as the Boy of Tikut, and discusses how these stories help us understand the psychology and societal dynamics of early America.
Through the conversation, Brendan highlights the ongoing relevance of these historical events in understanding contemporary issues related to spirituality, justice, and the human psyche.
Welcome to Witch Hunt, Brendan Walsh.
We're so happy that you're able to join with us today. Is there anything you'd like to share with our audience about your background as an independent scholar and your current interests?
So the main thing that I study in my career is witchcraft, demonic possession, ghosts, and, spiritual healing and exorcism, that sort of thing, during the 16th century and centuries in England in particular. And a lot of my work has been around the Puritan clergyman and exorcist John Darrell, who was a really important figure in this time period, and the debates and the controversies surrounding his activities during the 1590s in England are really important to understanding the development and status of demonic possession in the next century. So I've done a lot of work on John Darrell and the broader, spectrum of demonic possession in this period.
I'm really excited about the article and research that we're going to talk about today. Thank you so much for doing it, reading it. I'm going to be reading it still when this is over because I have so much I'm thinking about now. So thank you for that. What do we need to know about Cotton Mather and Memorable Providences relating to witchcrafts and possessions?
Yes, and this was a text written about 1689, and it's part of a genre sort of a providence text. So his father had also written a book like this, and basically the whole premise was trying to illustrate that God's providence was it's still in motion, and that how like extraordinary events like witchcraft, demonic possession, earthquakes, also signs of his continual interference activity in our plane. This is also sort of a retort to the skeptics that were starting to emerge, particularly in the late 17th century. A lot of intellectuals and individuals in England were beginning to, express public doubt about demonic possession and witchcraft. And Mather was trying to combat that by showing, there's actually plenty of these extraordinary events out there, and they're happening in New England especially. And this also plays into the sort of New England Puritan worldview. Like the Puritans in particular thought that they were God's chosen, and because of that, the devil would direct his wrath towards them especially. So because they had fled England to found a paradise in New England, the devil had followed them, and he was really trying to challenge them and upset their plans. And on the flip side, this is a intervention in God, because God himself is challenging them and testing their faith. And if the Puritans are able to overcome it, then that is a way to demonstrate and justify their faith.
And what was Mather's purpose in writing Memorable Providences?
Yeah, well, I think it's meant to showcase that these events are still happening, and also to prove the continued validity of demonic possession and witchcraft. So this particular book was written before Salem, and then so this is sort of a lead up to the events at Salem.
Who was the Boy of Tikut?
Okay, so the Born to Code is an account featured in this book by Cotton Mather. And he was a demoniac, a demonic possession victim, who was possessed sometime during the 1640s to 60s. We're not exactly sure the exact time frame. This account is missing a lot of detail. For one, we don't even know the boy's name. They just refer to him as the boy because that's sort of the convention to naming demoniacs in this period. Like there's back in England, you had the boy of Bilson, the boy of Northwich, that sort of thing. So yeah, it's very common to call a demoniac a boy in this situation. But on this account, we sort of have a rough time frame. We didn't know the boy's real name, and we're not even sure what happens to him in the end. So the account is incomplete. It ends 3/4 of the way through. So we're not sure if he's saved or he continues to be possessed or who he is. It just sort of peters out. But basically this whole account is focused on the concept of the demonic pact, also called the demonic compact, demonic league, demonic covenant. And in the story, the devil is trying to get the boy to submit to a demonic pact and forfeit his soul. As the devil always does, he's trying to get the individual, be they a witch or possession victim, to submit to him.
And he's in the colony of Connecticut or?
So this event takes place on the lands known as a Tokoket. So in the account, it's called a Tokoket, and that's where the current city of Branford, Connecticut now stands. And Branford is down the road from New Haven. So that's sort of like a very important area in the early period of Connecticut.
Right. And what makes this story stand out among tales of demonic possession?
Well, for one, it's probably the first demonic episode in both England and New England to focus the demonic pact in such a central way. And it also doesn't feature a witch, which is very unusual. In New England, only about 8 or 9 demoniacs during this period, and they all feature witchcraft apart from the boy of Tukut case. And in England, the vast majority of demonic possession cases features a witch in some capacity. So this one is just him being possessed, and it's also all centered on the demonic pact and how that plays out in the narrative.
The narrative it's like this conflict is relentless. That's one of the things that really hits me when I see some of these stories about the children and their afflictions in the colonies. It's just like this relentless.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's all about the devil just continually assaulting the individual, trying to wear down their will, trying to get them to submit at all costs. You know, that at the end of the day, the devil always wants like those tasty human souls. So it will do whatever it takes to get out of them.
And how would you define demonic possession?
Okay, demonic possession is a very sort of ancient tradition that is present in a lot of different cultures and time periods around the world. Typically in the Christian tradition, it is the idea that a demonic spirit will enter into the body of an individual, take control of them, and force them to act out and say things that they would never say. The symptoms usually involve something like, you know, you get increased strength, able to talk in a demonic voice, able to perform miraculous, pretty natural acts like flying or levitating. Often they invoke sort of beasts and animals and they're growling and grunting, things like that. So yeah, it's all the classic demonic possession things you've seen in the movies. It is pretty spot on there.
And what is the demonic pact and how does that fit into possession?
Yeah, so the demonic pact is a fundamental aspect of demonology, and it has been for centuries. In European demonology was the idea that the devil, particularly in regards to witchcraft, what the devil would entice someone or tempt someone to make an unholy agreement in return for either powers or material riches. So the individual would submit himself to the devil either for a series of years, like 7 years in servitude, or they would forfeit their soul. So even terms of forfeit, they would get some sort of material gain. And it's basically an inversion of the covenant between God and God's children. That demonic is all about the inversion of what is holy. So the demonic pact was crucial to understanding witchcraft and also demonic possession in some capacity during any time from the 14th to the 18th century. So while it was present in Europe, it wasn't in England in particular. It wasn't quite as featured heavily in these witchcraft and demonic possession accounts. It was featured in some form, the way there was a variation of the demonic pact in play. For example, in terms of witchcraft, the connection between the familiar spirit of the witch and the witch themselves was a type of demonic pact. For example, the idea in England was that the witch would gain powers through making an agreement with a familiar spirit, and they would suckle that spirit, and in exchange for blood, they would get powers from the spirit. So that's the witch familiar relationship is the key concept in England at this time. That demonic pact also plays a role in demonic possession, and you could almost say that the demonic pact is the end point of the possession. The whole point of the possession itself is for the devil or the demonic spirit to make the demoniac submit to them. So the devil is working towards making the person become their slave or forfeit their soul. And that demonic pact is the outcome of them successfully intimidating or forcing the demoniac.
And how does Cotton's account on the Boy of Tukut with the diabolic covenant, how does it conceptualize the boy's struggle against temptation?
I think the key consideration in this narrative is temptation. Temptation is a crucial element in Christianity in general, but particularly for the Puritans and in a Calvinist theology, temptation is massive. Sort of the essential fundamental concept, a lot of interactions with the devil and sort of resistance to the devil revolves around. You could always say that demonic possession is a form of temptation, as long as an extreme format. The devil is tempting the individual, and if they are not submitting, then they will heap on more torments, and the torment itself is the possession. So the temptation is working itself out through the status of demonic possession. Temptation is crucial. So all throughout the Boy of Tukut narrative, the devil is trying to get the boy to submit to him. At first, it's through temptation. He's offering him riches and status if the boy will submit to him. But the boy he wants to because he's a sinful boy, but he never explicitly commits to him. So as the story goes on, the devil starts getting frustrated, and the torments of the demoniac get worse and worse as things go on.
And in this story, there's a requirement for there to be an actual written agreement between the boy and the devil, right?
Yeah. The actual format of demonic pact sort of varies greatly between these stories. In the Boy of Tukut case, it's not exactly clear what form the contractual agreements take. It just usually described as some parchment with a pen with ink like blood. So majority of the times the demonic pact required a sign or a seal or a mark to be made in blood. This is very symbolic. The individual would give their blood to the devil, and in return, they would have the pact would be signed. In this narrative, the devil continues to put his pen and paper before the boy and make him sign, but he sort of never does. And this is really because for some reason, God keeps intervening in this case. Despite the boy being sinful, he's always saved at the last minute by God's grace. And I think this is sort of a moral to the audience that, yes, if you are sinful, you will invite the devil in. But at the same time, this is an assurance that God's grace, God's mercy is always in play. So have faith if you are experiencing any sort of conflict with the devil, because God can always save you.
And in your article, you discuss how this pact isn't intrinsically tied to witchcraft in Reformed Protestant demonology and could be mapped to other forms of diabolic affliction. Can you explain that to us?
The traditional understanding was that a demonic pact was related to witchcraft, but there's also cases where it pops up in demonic possession and other sort of encounters with the devil. And I should say that the demonic pact wasn't really adopted in England until about the 1630s or 40s during the Civil War. Before then, there was like the familiar witch relationship and things that are like the demonic pact, but the exact language of the demonic pact was not spelled out much later. And then in New England, when the Puritans moved over, they had the demonic pact sort of understanding sort of ingrained into them. So that's why we see this demonic pact acting itself out in these New England cases so importantly. But so the demonic pact can feature in any sort of demonic conflict. There's also stories of, it's a famous one with a Bavarian painter who is not really possessed, he's sort of afflicted by a devil, but he agrees to sort of give up his life or offer servitude in turn for like some great painting skills. So it doesn't need to be witchcraft or possession. There are other sort of episodes of demonic encounters where the demonic can feature.
How did anti-Dutch sentiments impact Mather's telling of the story?
So the boy himself is alluded to be Dutch, or at least he's from the Dutch Republic. We're not sure if he was born in Dutch Republic and moved over to New England when he was young, or he was born in England and moved to Dutch Republic. We're just not sure. But there is sort of a war between England and the Dutch Republic during this period. And there were other cases with my possession after this in which, anti-Dutch sentiment does pop up. And in particular for Brantford and New Haven, during the 1650s, there was a case where a lot of individuals from those settlements had moved north to try to settle some lands that were owned by the Dutch, and they were imprisoned after that. So, it's hitting very close to home, is anti-Dutch sentiment. And this idea that the boy in this narrative is from Dutch Republic, is Dutch, and he's so sinful, maybe that's sort of a dig at the Dutch, but that's sort of hard to say.
How was the boy's demonic possession different than others in colonial New England?
For one, it didn't really involve witchcraft at all. And as I said, this is unusual because witchcraft and demonic possession, typically in the Anglo tradition, was so intertwined during this period. It's to the point where in a lot of cases it is hard to actually distinguish between two conditions. So this is so much overlap in symptoms, in sort of reactions to it, that in a lot of cases you have to look really carefully to the language of the text to understand is this person possessed or is this person bewitched or a combination of both. And this is in popular texts and in popular understanding, these people didn't really distinguish between the two. They just sort of thought, oh, thought you were, you know, the witch is saying is being possessed. Like this idea of being attacked by a demonic spirit, a familiar spirit, was awful to say. It's only when you sort of go to, like, you know, the learned texts by people like William Perkins, we see that, yes, there are sort of, you know, strict boundaries between these conditions. And in the Boy Tocotte case, it's all about temptation. It's all about him directly dealing with the devil, which is not the case in other New England possession cases or witchcraft cases. And I think the reason why witchcraft features so heavily in demonic possession cases was, A, because witchcraft was the predominant sort of affliction for demonic encounters for centuries. It was another one. So it was a primary one, and possession was sort of a secondary one. And number two, I think having a witch in a story sort of provides a human face to a demonic encounter. Like, you can't put the devil on trial, but you can put a witch on trial for the devil's deed. So this is a way to achieve some sort of justice in this situation where normally you can't totally achieve a victory over the devil. You can beat him back, but he'll always sort of return to afflict humanity.
How does Du Bois' case offer insight into the development of demonic covenant theology in New England?
So yeah, so we can sort of see that this is one of the first cases of demonic possession in New England. And I think it would be a big influence on other cases after this. So after this, during this 16th century, we have the case of Elizabeth Knapp, who was also a possession, and sort of the demonic pact and covenant features are quite importantly in that narrative as well. And also in Salem. Salem itself has a big emphasis on demonic pacts. And so, yeah, as is the case with these possession narratives, it's all sort of based on early ones and their traditions and tropes, all part of the genre that these individuals all draw from in acting out their symptoms and also recording their symptoms and sort of reactions.
It's so interesting to me because it's, you know, many of us who start to learn about the trials at the very beginning, we know a little bit and it's about Salem, but what we don't really know, we don't really understand it. And sometimes we're hearing, oh, these afflicted girls were possessed. And then sometimes we're hearing, oh, you know, these witches were possessed. But this actually kind of helps sort that out because there's like this progression. And I was thinking about the devil's book. What is the devil's book versus a contract with the devil? Is it the same?
It sort of depends on the context, but you can think of the devil's book is a collection of contracts. So in all the witchcraft and possession cases in New England, there's the devil's book, which the devil presents to the witch or the demoniac and asks them to sign. And in Salem, this features very prominently. I think Tituba sort of discusses the demonic book in her testimony and uses it as a way to point fingers at other individuals who are witches. So this is, I think, from purely like in terms of the narrative, a demonic book is a way to have a framing device to implicate others as witches. In a lot of the cases, the individual is shown the book and then they're able to see who else has signed it or left their mark. And because of that, they'll say, oh, this person here is a witch, this person here is a witch. And so it sort of leads to more accusations. And it also plays into the idea that, you know, the witch as a demonic religion itself, is this idea that, yes, like this is a grand army, a devil's assembling of witches and other sort of depraved people, and he's collecting their agreements in the book, and this unholy book is sort of a inversion of the Bible, that sort of thing. And also in regards to Salem, Yeah, there is some debate around the idea that they're bewitched or possessed in Salem, the afflicted girls. I think that's all based on the idea of the specters that they're attacked with. That sort of can be interpreted as a demonic spirit attacking them, which sort of is demonic possession or demonic obsession. But that's a very confusing and complex topic. So we're still working out what exactly they were in Salem.
Does his specter come into the story at all?
No, there's no sort of specters at all in this narrative. There's demonic, the devil attacking him, but there's no sort of specters. And also, I just discussed demonic obsession, so I'll flesh that out a bit.
Cool.
Demonic obsession, sort of the outward form of demonic possession is when the devil is attacking from the outside rather than actually getting inside your body and taking control of you. So it's usually the status or the condition that precedes demonic possession. First you are obsessed by the devil and then you are possessed after that if he gets through your spiritual armor into your body. And demonic possession, so in the grand scheme of things, over the 7th century, it sort of overtakes demonic possession a little bit later. We sort of, as theologians start to move away from such a physical understanding of demonic influence in their lives, they sort of start to place more emphasis on the idea of a mental or a spiritual conflict or attack by the devil. So demonic possession is sort of over time comes the predominant form of demonic interaction and conflict. So yes, the idea that the devil's perhaps not attacking us in a physical sense anymore, but he's still afflicting humanity through inserting dark thoughts, making us question our faith, that sort of thing. So demonic possession is very important, but it's during the mid-7th century wherein the boy to cotton narrative takes place, it's still sort of gaining steam, and demonic possessions is still a big thing.
How did the boy invite Satan in?
Yeah, so the story begins in a Dutch public, and the boy is described as being as sinful. He's a bad kid. He's hanging out with a bad crowd. He's getting involved in these sort of immoral acts. And because of this, he is inviting the devil in through his sinful acts. At this time, he's like 7 or 8. So this is a very staunch Puritan view of morality. His father was a preacher, so perhaps it adds in more emphasis to his bad deeds. And during this time in Holland, he sort of, as he gets older, he starts hanging around with his background more and more. And because of that, the devil starts to appear to him. At first, he appears as a boy and sort of asks him to, to sign a covenant. And the boy wants to, he's depraved, so immoral. So yes, he would like to align himself with the devil, but he's preserved by the grace of God. So again, this ongoing conflict throughout the next few years in which, the boy continues to act out, the devil continues to hound him, but he is, he's saved by God. So he gets to the point eventually where his father he thinks it'd be better to send his son off to New England to join other members of his family. Perhaps that's a way to get him, to get him free of this bad crowd in Dutch public. So it's, sometime when he's like 13, 14, about an age, he's sent over to New England and he stays with his brother in Bradford. So that's that. And this is the time period where his interactions with the devil start intensifying and the devil's getting frustrated and the possession starts in earnest.
Is there anything else in the narrative that gives us insight into how they viewed the devil or how he, wore down his victims?
So yeah, the devil would do whatever it takes to wear down his victims, either through, temptations, it's like sweet temptations, offering them wealth and power. And then when that fails, he starts to get violence. He starts to, you know, go into the boy, possess him, make him have fits and seizures and levitate. And at the end, it gets so bad that the story says there his body is falling off the ground and is inserted into like the rafters. They sort of like get stuck in little holes. It's really weird, but yes, the servants try to find him and they see him up in the rafters in a tiny hole, like his body contorted and jammed in there. So yeah, it gets to the point where the devil's actually inflicting serious physical pain and torment upon the boy in the effort to make him agree to forfeit his soul.
I think the boy was a little acrobat or something.
Well, yeah, I forgot to say about all demoniacs. Yes, they all have this ability to contort their bodies and, you know, in very strange manners.
And what did the devil ask the boy to do for him?
And well, majority of time was to sign the covenant, but he also wanted him to sort of commit evil deeds. That's what the devil does. The devil wants his sons to go out in the world and spread chaos. And there's one episode in the narrative where, you know, the boy is testing out the devil's powers, and he asks him, "Oh, if you can turn my spit scalding, I'll spit on this dog and burn it." And the devil agrees, and the boy spits on the dog and the dog is burned. So yeah, the devil is able to grant some sort of powers in existence as long as it sort of suits his needs.
And then what is the point at which he goes from obsessed to possessed?
Yeah, there's a point in the narrative where his brother begins to have convulsions and fits. We're not sure that's connected to the possession. Like, it was his brother being possessed? It's never sort of implied, but his brother is sick and the boy begins to mock him and he's sort of his illness. And that seems to be the point where the devil begins to possess him fully. And this also comes after, you know, years of trying to get the boy to submit to him, and eventually he gets frustrated and fed up and decides, no, this is time to possess the boy to make him, you know, to make him submit my will fully. So this is not the case with all demonic possession narratives, but at least in this case, there's a clear transition from sort of a conflict with the devil, a spiritual obsession, to a possession. It's marked very clearly in the narrative.
What moral lessons could the New Englanders learn from this story?
Well, I think the most important one is that if you are sinful, it will invite the devil in. This is obviously, it's all possession and witchcraft pamphlets and narrative were a way to moralize people. They're saying this is the consequence of sin. This is what happens when you are sinful and evil. You can be possessed or be attacked by a witch or even become a witch, essentially. And number two is that no matter how bad things seem, God can always preserve you and save you. So yeah, so in case of the boy, despite him being sinful and being tormented by the devil, God always saves him at the last minute. So yeah, there's always hope, there's always faith that you can get through what any demonic encounter. And this is the idea that theologians praise, that, you know, God will never subject you to anything that you cannot handle. Like, God always knows exactly your limits, and you can feel assured that whatever you're going through, you have the strength and the power to overcome it. And then that's probably, you know, the most hopeful, reassuring part of a Calvinist theology, that the God is the Almighty and can do everything.
So then God has a role there with the boy even before confession.
Yeah. That God is continually interfering in all matters at all times. So yes, this goes into a broader idea about the role of demonic possession in society. So going back to that clergyman John Darrell last talking about before, John Dowell and other theologians as well, but he had this idea that demonic possession was ordained by God, and it was a marker or a symbolic condition in which the sort of God's plan was revealed to the world. So a possession is ordained for the particular reason, either to punish the wicked or to test the faithful. And through a possession is sort of a call to arms. If someone's possessed, then this is a sign that you have to perform a certain series of actions or perform an exorcism on them. And so this idea that, yes, God has a grand plan, and a demonic possession is part of his plan. So you as a demoniac and people around them can take assurance that this is not some chaotic random event. This is all part of the grand scheme that you have a part to play.
And this story in Cotton Mather's account is incomplete. So we don't know for sure what becomes of the boy or even who Cotton Mather got the account from.
Yeah, it sort of ends the course of the way through. It ends with the boy just being possessed still. And we're not sure if he recovered or if he continued on for some time. The account comes from Cotton Mather's grandfather. We're not sure what grandfather, but one of his grandfathers 30 years ago, prior to his 1589, he either recorded this possession himself or got it from someone else who was there at the scene. So, and at the end of the count, Cotton Mather says, I'm not sure what happened in the end, but I'm sure it was great. But this does happen. There's a lot of possession accounts which are unfinished. And that also plays into the idea that, you know, sometimes an exorcism was not needed because the demonic possession was the event in itself and would result through God's intervention alone without us humans getting involved. So it really depends on the context and sort of the group involved in it. But yeah, there's a lot of accounts of possession that are not finished. And we always have to sort of try to work out what happened after this point.
Yeah. So this account does not include an exorcism.
No. There is a clergyman who attends the boy. His name is Abraham Pearson. And he is the only reason why we can date this text, because he was in Bradford, Queens, 1640s and 60s, and then he left Bradford. So his presence in the narrative is the only mark we have of a time frame at all. And so Pearson was there to, you know, help soothe the boy and also hear his confession. A confession was a really important part of the possession narrative, because it was, you know, a confession in general was a way to submit yourself to God and sort of reveal your sins and misdeeds. And in the case of this matter, the devil is trying to prevent the boy confessing at all costs. There's an idea that the devil's power over the demoniac or their contractual agreement with the demoniac would sort of fail if the person confessed to it. The idea that a confession would undo this contract or undo the power over it. So at all costs, a confession was needed. The devil would also, you know, have ways to avoid a confession. In this case, he would stop the boy from talking, either through, you know, his own, either through invading his mind or stopping his vocal cords. There are ways that he can prevent the boy from actually speaking out loud. So yes, he would do whatever he takes to prevent the boy from speaking his confession.
Yeah, I was going to ask, so there, you know, looking at this narrative, this little fella, you know, had years of torment. Was there no confession within all of that, or would have there been, and then, you know, he was broken down again?
We're not really sure from the narrative. He does confess towards towards that Pearson eventually, and that sort of grants him some resolve. But it just is not enough. Like I don't think he confessed everything. All the devils hold over him was too great at this time period. A confession is important, but it's not the final solution. There's other things involved in there to rid the board of the demonic influence.
Would have they ever had him write a confession?
I'm not exactly sure. So it all depends. And I'm sure the boy could write. He was, you know, he was his father was a priest, right? He was educated. So I would say no. I think in most cases of possession that the demoniac would speak their confession to the people at their bedside, and they would record it themselves and include it in the. So yeah, I think the confession was verbal, and in this time period, like the word of God, hearing the word of God or hearing confession, the word of mouth was more important, it seems.
This has been great. Thank you so much. Is there anything else that you wanted to be sure to cover about this, or anything else that you're working on?
I think I should talk about demonic possession in general. I sort of skipped over it at the start. So demonic possession in the 16th and 17th century was sort of caught up in this confessional conflict between the Protestants and the Catholics. We see that sort of possession sort of was happening a lot more. This is the golden age of demonic possession. And for certain clergymen and exorcists, they're using exorcism as a form of, maybe of, how to term it, spiritual propaganda. If you're able to perform a successful exorcism, then this is a sign that your faith, that your denomination is superior to other ones and is also blessed by God. So during this time period, we see that there's a lot more possessions happening and a lot more exorcisms happening as well. And this is sort of a way to get one over on either the Catholics or the Protestants. And typically with John Darrell, that individual I mentioned before, he was a Puritan clergyman who was trying to reclaim or remake exorcism for Protestants. There was the idea that the Catholics always had an advantage in this propaganda war because their version of the ritual was so elaborate and dramatic. They would have like a whole series of rites to read out. They would use incense and crucifixes and bells and all sorts of dramatic stage props to make the whole process a lot more dramatic and entertaining. So obviously the Protestants didn't like that. If all was too ornate, they thought that, you know, it was almost like magical witchcraft in itself. So people like Darrell were trying to establish a simplified form of the ritual that was much more closely attuned to what, you know, what was in scripture. So the idea was more in years like Darrell to return to the authority of the scriptures and make a form of exorcism that was, you know, more closely aligned to what Jesus Christ did, because, you know, they base their activities off what Jesus did in the Bible. There's a few years, many episodes in the Bible where Jesus would be presented with a possessed child or possessed individual and perform an exorcism on them. And so his simple way of going about it was prayer and fasting. So I think in book 9 of Mark, he tells his disciples, this kind comes forth by nothing except prayer and fasting. So those words form the basis of what clergymen would use in their rituals for Protestants to dispossess or exorcise them during this period. And particularly with John Darrell, he was attempting to make a ritual that would strike out against the Catholics and also his enemies inside the Church of England. And because of this, he got in trouble with the church authorities in England, and in 1598 was placed on trial and convicted of fraud. And because of the whole debate over his ministry and the various books that came out about and after his trial, the Church of England banned his ritual essentially in 1604. They introduced a church canon law that forbid all clergymen from performing exorcism without getting the explicit permission of a bishop. And because the bishops in England were all very much skeptical or against this ritual, a sort of stop with clergy's being involved in his ritual throughout this entire century. So in New England, it's a bit different because there was the sort of Puritans that escaped England and the tyrannical church. So there's a lot more instances of clergymen and other learned individuals performing a dispossession during this time period. So that sort of plays into this, you know, this idea of bishop propaganda. But yeah, you have to acknowledge that it's a cloud over the clergy's role in his ritual during the 17th century.
I was wondering thank you for that background on that. I was wondering on Cotton's including this, you know, he didn't know the Salem witch trials were coming. I just really wonder when he looked back at that. I don't know. I wonder how that played into his actions or thoughts or writings later. It's, you know, with the afflicted girls. What about that narrative that Cotton said really is like the most interesting thing to you, or do you think is like important?
I think it's important for not including a witch. That is unusual from this time period. And it's also, you know, in the book that it features in, it's sort of part of the, you know, these other accounts that are meant to testify for the continued existence of possession and witchcraft. So what if I remember that Salem was 1692, is that right? So like, yeah, this book came out 30 years before it. I think Cotton Mather himself was trying to defend his actions or influence over Salem many years afterwards. So I'm not sure exactly what he would think of these events in relation to Salem, but I think he's committed to his, you know, his book and what it meant.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful getting to talk to you and meet you. Now here's Sarah with End Witch Hunts News.
Welcome to End Witch Hunts News. There is a significant importance in both preserving our witch trial historical sites and addressing the unresolved injustices of people of the witch trials. Those two matters are interconnected in our understanding and respect for witch trial cultural heritage. Let's talk historical neglect. Ingersoll's Tavern, built around 1670 and located in Danvers, Massachusetts in the historical district, represents a crucial piece of American history, particularly linked to the Salem witch trials. Despite its significance, the building, privately owned, has been vacant for 13 years and is deteriorating. Please do not trespass at the tavern. It is still private property. Let's reflect on the important work being done by the Massachusetts Witch Hunt Justice Project, which emerged in response to the absence of an official state apology for the witch trial victims. It's their stories that underscore the historical significance of Ingersoll's Tavern. Parallel to the physical neglect of Ingersoll's Tavern, there's an ongoing absence of an official apology from the Massachusetts General Court for the colony's witchcraft trials. This reflects a broader popular disregard for acknowledging and rectifying past injustices. We'd like to thank the Historic District Commission in Danvers for working with the town of Danvers to find a solution for Ingersoll's Tavern. Addressing these issues isn't just about preserving a building, but involves a deeper acknowledgement of historical mistakes. Seeking an apology from the judicial system that once sanctioned these witchcraft trials is not merely symbolic. It's a step toward healing and honoring those unjustly persecuted. Protecting this historical site's demise is an action of recognizing and honoring the cultural heritage of witch trials. Social media is revealing there is a collective desire for reconciliation, justice, and story preservation. You can take action. Sign the petition for an apology at change.org/witch trials. And join the new Facebook group called Save Ingersoll's Tavern to join the conversation and show your support of preservation action. We are immensely grateful to all the experts in the Salem witch trial history industry for their valuable efforts. A special thank you goes out to those who initiated and are managing the Facebook group aimed at organizing our Ingersoll Tavern's community voice. Your actions strengthened our community's engagement and advocacy. Thank you for your hard work and for keeping our history alive and relevant. Collective voice is impactful. By adding your voice, you are calling for justice. You do play a crucial role, not a crucible role, in shaping how history is remembered and learned from. It's an opportunity to demonstrate collaboration, compassion, and a commitment to correcting historical wrongs. It's an opportunity to model intervention on historical neglect. Interested in discovering the role of Ingersoll's Tavern during the 1692 and 93 witchcraft accusations? Please follow our daily video reports on the Salem Witch Hunt social media account. Watch Josh and other project members present daily insights into the Salem witch trial history, tailored to each specific date. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome.
And thank you for listening to Witch Hunt.
Join us next week.
Have a great today and a beautiful tomorrow.